Hi, and welcome to the Plan 8 Podcast, a technology podcast out of Baltimore, Maryland. Today we're having a panelist discussion, the nice, the naughty, and the tiny Tim. Today I have guest panelists Tim Keneally.
Hello.
Mark Millen from the LA Times.
Hello.
And Gus Sentimentes from the Baltimore Sun.
Howdy.
How are you guys all doing today on this lovely snow-covered day on the East Coast? And then for Mark, your lovely sunny day on the West Coast.
Sunny, I'm wearing a t-shirt right now. So wow. It sucks for you guys.
We're jealous.
Totally.
You know what? LA will fall into the water sometime, and we will laugh,
Oh.
So, okay, today, guys, the panel discussion is about the nice, the naughty, and the tiny Tim. And to clarify that for our listeners who might be getting the analogy to the good, the bad, and the ugly, today we're talking about who were the nice companies, the naughty companies, and those who are going to not make it much longer without serious help if the tech companies of 2009. So, we'll start out with the nice. What is everyone's nice company of the year? I'll start with Tim.
Well, I was thinking of Motorola, actually, for having seriously turned around the public's opinion of their handset division. You know, their infrastructure business and their services for WiMAX, LTE, and stuff like that have always been strong, but there was a period of time when people were talking about their handset division and how it should be spun off and how it was terrible and how it hadn't had anything good since, you know, the Razer back, whatever, and, you know, a couple of years ago. And now that they've switched over to Android and are pushing that strongly, the Droid has done extremely well. So I think while it may not be nice in the sense of, you know, they were kind, I think they were nice in that they really have magnificently turned around one of their divisions.
What do you guys think about that, Mark?
So they weren't being nice, they were nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, how long is the Droid going to last, though? I think it's only good because it's the first Android phone on Verizon, so people on this network with a ton of crappy phones are like, finally, we have a good phone. But I think once the Nexus One comes out next year, how long is Droid going to be the go-to phone?
Well, I think that's something that Android faces the rest of its life, actually, is every phone is going to have to come out and be the best phone. So,
but can Motorola continue to be nice? Because, I mean, the Droid isn't even that great of a phone. The keyboard sucks on it. I mean, it has a lot of great features, but the keyboard is so bad.
But, I mean, as far as Android is concerned, it's the best phone available. So I think that is the main thing that they had to do. I agree that the keyboard is, I wouldn't say it sucks, but it takes a lot of getting used to. And I know I've heard people say that they actually like it because, I know all the buttons touch and it's flat and flush against the thing. But
software keyboards take a lot to get used to, and I think that's a better investment with your learning time than trying to learn that Droid keyboard.
Hey, what's your view on this, Gus?
Yeah, I think there's always going to be a big, huge market for smartphones with, you know, physical keyboards. So in that sense, I think the Droid is like the first heavy-duty, serious smartphone built for that physical keyboard loving crowd, I think. I mean, it's a pretty potent piece of hardware and software, just the combination. The keyboard itself isn't great. But, I mean, with HTC, you know, coming out with the Nexus One, I mean, I've been playing with an HTC Aeris, which is kind of like it's like a smaller touchscreen only phone. And it feels nice in the palm. There's going to be that appeal to for people who just want the software keyboard. That's always going to be there. But at the same time, you know, the Motorola Droid is appealing to to pretty sizable, you know, millions of people who want that physical keyboard.
See, I've had I didn't put a lot of stock in the Nexus One because I've had personally I've had three HTC phones and I've been given a number of them to work with and to review, and they always seem really flimsy. And if I mean, I haven't handled the Nexus One, so I can't, you know, speak about that directly, but if it's competing against the iPhone with the typical HTC sort of lightness, flimsiness, smallness, I'd even say, mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys have had any more experience with it than I have, or what do you think about that?
I have to say the Nexus One, which is also going to be branded as the HTC, as the Droid Passion on Verizon, supposedly, is from all accounts, it's a pretty ridiculously awesome phone. The screen is slightly larger than the iPhone screen, yet at a much higher resolution. I believe it's 800 by 450. It also is an AMOLED screen, which is an active matrix organic LED, which means it's not going to take much power at all to charge that screen with a much higher, you know, quality of image. And just some of the other features that are going to be in it, they're going to have it also as the GSM phone, which is going to be the Nexus One. Mm-hmm. But from all accounts, it's going to have Android 2.1, and they're going to have the TouchSense UI available for it when it comes out as the Passion, supposedly, for Verizon 2. So I think HTC One told what to make. Makes terrible phones. I mean, look at some of the Motorola rebrands and Samsung rebrands they've done for Windows mobile phones. But when they're allowed their own devices and not, like, forced to do a design based on committee, particularly which the G1 was, I think they can make some amazing handsets. For example, look at the HD2, which, for God's sake, makes me actually want a Windows mobile phone.
That's, amazing.
From what we're hearing about the Nexus One is that Google was the one who's dictating what it should be. So I think if somebody good is telling them what to make, they can make something good.
Mm-hmm. All right, so to go away from talking about Motorola and mobile phones, Gus, who was your for the nice list this year?
Well, I chose a web software company, Twitter. I thought Twitter was a good contender for nice company of the year. They definitely sort of came out of the woodwork and hit the mainstream in 2009. And, I kind of get the feeling like, you know, they don't have like the same model as Google, which is like do no evil, but you kind of get the feeling that the company's leaders want to do some good. You know, they're not rushing their growth and expansion. They haven't like plastered the site with like Google ads. They're taking time to test and add features to what is already a fairly successful, if kind of, you know, glitchy occasionally communication platform. You've seen Twitter used in Iran and, you know, dictatorial regimes, you know, and they've got like this serious venture capital money behind them. So they're not really rushing to kind of, you know, their monetization efforts don't reek of desperation yet. I don't know.
Yet they're still going to turn a profit at the end of the year.
Oh, are they? Yeah.
Just to be believed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you see that Business Week story?
No, I didn't. No.
Based on the search deals with Google and Microsoft, they're expected to turn a profit in 2009.
Yeah. Crazy. What do you guys think? Yeah.
I think when it comes to Twitter, there are so many people when I talk to them about it, I guess not even necessarily old school people, but people who are not tech people don't get it. My sister doesn't get it. My doctor doesn't get it. Someone I was talking to about how I use it for most of the Planet podcast, its main website is the Planet Podcast Twitter feed, which then links out to the WordPress blog. And it makes a nice, clean way of allowing access to that information, saying, hey, here's the new story, click link, go to blog. And I know it will work on a phone, but when it comes to it, people still just don't get, you know, how you're supposed to write a concise message in under 140 characters. And I think that the one thing that's great about Twitter is, again, like, if I'm in another country where maybe internet's not as reliable, but I have access to SMS, I mean, that's how all the information from Iran got out, was through SMS to Twitter. And right. I think you're going to see the ability of searching for something like quick news searches, you know, integrated with more news features as well. I mean, you already see CNN having their Twitter feed of news. And I think what you might see then is you're going to see the Twitter rumor news feed versus the Twitter official news feed and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think another reason everybody has just been hearing about Twitter is because journalists have really caught on to it. And like, but I think I've also been reading stories that Twitter's growth month over month has been slowing, which kind of makes you wonder, where is the sort of natural ceiling, you know, for Twitter's growth and capacity? Like, will it, it probably will never be as big as Facebook, or maybe it will, you know, or will it be just sort of like a service that, you know, people in media, people in marketing, people in PR, people in tech, you know, people maybe in academia or nonprofits, or they're using, you know, really commonly, but it's just not as broadly appealing as something like Facebook is.
I think you're right. I think Twitter has this narrow focus, like this person who is eager to have information coming at them from every direction and can call their own news sources. And I think Facebook appeals to everybody because, hopefully everybody has friends and wants to connect with a certain group of people, but not everybody wants to be consuming news and be consuming information in small bites.
I think the one thing, if you look about Twitter now, it's almost like it's that old news ticker from the 30s and 20s where it's like, I got a big scoop. Let's leave what's on the ticker, you know? You just expect to have a guy with the 2020 card in his hat saying, this is good news. I'm going to write it down. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, back in Windows 95, I had that black and red ticker going right under my my top bar, right under my start menu.
Yeah, it's I really think Twitter is an interesting creature in this time and age. I think it's going to become – I think it's one of those kind of technologies that is always going to be more popular in Europe and in – the areas where the mobile internet is far more prevalent, because the fact is people have phones first rather than computers first. Mm-hmm. I mean, that whole idea of – that whole paradigm, pardon my overused word of the century.
Ooh, paradigm.
I know. I might even say shift in there sometime as well.
This guy knows what he's talking about.
Real-time web.
Web 2.0. But yeah, besides the whole paradigm that is not used to in America, text messaging is something that's just finally being picked up, since you now have these unlimited plans in the United States in the last just 5 years. But in Europe, the whole thing was you receive text messages for free. And now they're starting to charge for it, but they're starting to get those unlimited plans like they now have in the States. And so while Europe is on that very much that mindset still, hey, I can get text messages for free and stuff like that, they're used to it. I think that's where it's really going to grow out the most, is places where the phone comes first, computer comes second.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Now, Mark, who is your nice company of the year?
My nice company of the year, which I don't think really set themselves to the standard until late in the year, is Google. Because in a year when everybody, especially in the tech industry, is complaining about downsizing and the economy and cutting down, they made a ton of acquisitions just in the past 5 months. Starting in August, they got, six companies, I think.
Right.
So I mean, in a time where startups are struggling, everybody wants to be bought, and they're just hoping for an acquisition, Google is coming in and gobbling up companies, and not undervalued. I think maybe somebody like Gizmo might have been undervalued at $30 million, because that's essentially going to be – I think that's going to be a huge product for Google.
Yeah,
building VoIP into Google Voice.
Yeah, I completely agree. The fact that they're now officially saying that Google Voice will be integrated with the domain apps, as someone who uses the domain apps as the primary source of my, you know, network's email and other services – it's going to be extremely helpful to me once that gets integrated. And then if you can have a desktop client that then integrates with, you know, also the phone, like if they have a client on an Android phone, I'm going to be a very happy camper.
Right. I mean, that's basically your phone service. Once it's got VoIP built in, I mean, Google Voice itself is a great service for your phone. But once it gets VoIP built in, I mean, that's your phone service.
Yeah, I think, Mark, you make a really good point because, I mean, Google, you know, in a tough, you know, recessionary environment, you know, there aren't a lot of companies that are able to go for the IPO and strike it rich. But Google has been providing exits to a lot of different kinds of companies, you know, and their venture capital investors. And they've been really priming the pump in a couple of different industries, you know, whenever they make a big acquisition, which they're trying to do like once a month now, right?
Right. And, I mean, they bought three companies in November, two on the same day.
Right, yeah.
But AdMob and Gizmo on November 9th, Harrison the 23rd, which I didn't know.
Yeah, they bought AdMob, and actually one of AdMob's biggest competitors is right here in Baltimore. It's a little company called Millennial Media, and as soon as Google bought AdMob, Millennial was just like over the moon. They were super excited because they're saying, hey, you know, maybe there's a big payoff, you know, in our future in the next year or so. You know, maybe Apple or Microsoft will come along and want to buy up another company. You know, so like that, you're right. That there's a really big trickle-down effect when a huge player like Google can suddenly start dumping its cash into like these different industries.
But on the other side of the coin, when Google enters a services space and offer something to the consumer for free, don't you think it has a negative effect on competition?
You just took my naughty.
I'm sorry.
Right. Well,
I mean that. I just met with the guys at TomTom, and one of my first questions was, "How do you compete with free? I mean, it's free. The GPS is free on the Droid. How do you compete with that?" And they're just repositioning themselves, and this is a big concern because they just saunter into random industries, and the second they make that announcement, like 20 companies' stocks drop 25%.
To go on to the next nice company, the one that I chose, I have to say, Mark, you stole mine.
Yes.
You damn dirty bastard. trying to figure out another one while we were talking, I have to say probably a nice company would have to be HTC, because again, HTC is coming out like bangbusters. I mean, their new ads, I think, were one of the first things I really noticed, where it's like quietly brilliant, and that's so apropos to their, because the fact that they were such a background person for so long, being an OEM for all these different phones that people didn't know about. I mean, that they didn't know that they actually made them, then they were just rebranded, and now they're starting to get into this strut where the Droid Passion or HTC Snapdragon was out and was fully designed and was all done before supposedly Google got their hands on it to make it the Nexus. And it was a beautiful phone and is a beautiful phone. But, you know, people are going to know it as the Nexus One first once Google gets it out. But their principles in design, I mean, you look at their user interface that they've added onto either Windows Mobile, which makes Windows Mobile usable, or to the Droid, which makes it very ubiquitously beautiful and much more intuitive than the traditional user interface that is with the Android phones. And I think that they're personally my choice for the nice company of the year.
So are you saying, how much of an impact do you think that their branded UI has? Like, this is something that is very interesting to me because you see that a lot of companies are picking up Android and then putting their own UI on top of it. Do you think that the Sense UI is superior just because it was the first one out there, or do you think that it really has some staying power?
I think all I have to say is Windows Mobile. I'm sorry. The fact that HTC was able to make Windows Mobile a usable platform with like looking at the phone of the HD2.
I would beg to differ. I have an HTC Pure, and it's an all right phone, but it's 6.5. It's just cringe.
Play with the HD2, where they actually have a processor fast enough to move the pile of crap that is underneath that pretty interface.
That's true. I think the Pure's processor isn't even. It's like 500.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I think the one thing is HTC has a design team that's really just that it's on that same par as I think almost like Apple, where it's like the user interface and their software is very much about function and form together in this beautiful synergy. And they try to work with what they got. And so
one of the really nice things about HTC is that it's a Taiwanese company that has taken ownership of its brand and proved itself that they can design. I mean, a lot of things are manufactured in Taiwan, but it's always just made in Taiwan, maybe designed in Japan or designed in the United States. But this is like a Taiwanese brand that says, we can do this. We can do this all ourselves.
That's true. Taiwan is actually coming out with Asus is Taiwanese, isn't it? Or Asus, I don't know however you say it.
Asus Tech is the company name. Asus.
Are they Taiwanese? I think they are.
They are Taiwanese. Yeah.
It's a good place to be right now.
Because it's all the power of China's production, but none of their craziness. Except in government, where they start having politicians throw staplers at each other.
Oh, that's just standard practice for
If only we had more of that here.
We're on par with that in the United States soon. But so now we're getting to the naughty list. I think we'll start with Gus. Who was your naughty company of 2009?
I kind of had it as a tie between AT&T and Apple.
Okay. All right, you can choose only one, sir. One child has to stay back on the train station. The other one can go with
you. I sort of like chose to focus on like one issue that is shared by both companies, which I think they're both responsible for, which is the crappy telephone service for the iPhone. And you know, AT&T has gotten a real black eye over you know in the Verizon commercials and you know subscribers you know criticizing it for poor 3G coverage and dropped phone calls, and especially in big cities like New York and San Francisco. But there was this really interesting New York Times article. I think it was over on the Bits blog the reporter wrote about just some of you know he interviewed some experts in the cell phone field who talked about some of the design flaws in the Apple iPhone and how it actually can be a challenge in phone for telephone service, you know. So, and the point of his story was that, hey, you know, like Apple has managed to duck some of this blame. And, but to me, I think they share responsibility for this problem, and they both haven't done a good enough job to address it for their, you know, subscribers and customers. So yeah, I mean, I don't mean to pick two companies. I figured it's one issue that they're both dealing with, but one has to deal with a little bit more than the other.
It's okay, Gus. We know you think you're special and you can choose two at once. So we'll let it go by.
I just can't make a decision. I'm sorry.
Indecisive.
Mark, what's your view on that?
Yeah, I saw that New York Times article. I thought it was crap because the iPhone is not only in the U.S. So we have a point of comparison. You go overseas, and the good telecoms that have the iPhone can provide good service. And granted, the iPhone's phone is not the best. I mean, the call quality, like the voice quality, is not that great. But you can still make a connection anywhere in Europe. I mean, this is the network's fault, and it's not just iPhones. I talk to my friends who have AT&T Blackberries, and their service is just not that great. And I don't know if that's them being naughty and maybe just not really able to invest in the towers and the infrastructure, but that was the argument of that Times article was crap.
Yeah. Right, Tim, what do you think of this?
Well, I was actually thinking how Gus set it up perfectly for a joke there about how Apple could be the naughty and AT&T could be the Tiny Tim because it's crippled.
Well played, sir. Well played. You are a gentleman and a scholar for today's episode.
I win.
So, guys, what is your retort to what Mark said?
I think that's a good point. I mean, I remember I was actually over in Europe a couple of months ago, and I was able to get phone service in the remote countryside in Greece. I was a little surprised by that, actually. It was a very odd feeling to be surfing.
And I have trouble getting service in the remote countryside of Hollywood.
Right. Yeah, so I think it's a good point, and it's one that I didn't consider, honestly. So kudos to Mark, definitely.
Okay. So Mark, who is your naughty for the year?
See, I couldn't come up with a great one. I think AT&T is pretty good, but I chose Facebook just because of their most recent privacy issues, which is kind of like par for the course with Facebook. They keep dropping the ball time and time again. But the most recent issue was I'm sure everybody who's listening is on Facebook and got that privacy alert, like, change your privacy settings. And it defaults to, like, opening up all of your information. And just 20 minutes ago, it's Christmas time, so my parents are in town. I was sitting down with my mom. She was logging onto Facebook for the first time in a week, and she got this privacy thing, and she's just trying to check her sister's profile, and she's just clicking through. I'm like, Mom, wait, you're about to open up your entire profile to Google and the rest of the world. So, I mean, I think it was just kind of sleazy, and it's just a part of this, like, constant sleazy efforts of Beacon, which they finally just settled, and right after Beacon, they're like almost back to their same practices.
Mm-hmm. Tim?
I agree. I mean, I'm not a total Facebook creeper or anything, but after they changed privacy settings, I could see people's profiles who I was not friends with, who I was sort of semi-stalking. So I fear what, you know, who is looking at my information. So, you know, I had to roll it all back, and it was really done in such a poor way. Just like Mark said, it's, you know, the menu that people were presented with was to say, okay, this is open, or have it the old way. So it didn't really tell you what was going on, and it was just really poorly done. And exactly. It's just par for the course for them.
Gus, what do you think?
Yeah, I think sort of Facebook's DNA, like when people sign up for that site, you know, they kind of think they're going to have, you know, default to a certain level of privacy. You're going to have your private network of friends and relatives. So for Facebook to sort of change the terms and default and make it public like that, it's they're sort of breaking that covenant with, you know, the people who are using that site, I think, and who kind of come to it with a certain presumption that this is going to be a closed type of networking site that you have to really take several steps to put yourself out there to the general public. You know, it's not Twitter. I mean, when you sign up for Twitter, you know, I mean, unless you protect your Twitter updates, you know, and lock them down, there is that, you know, you're on a service that's going to be available to all. You know, it's in Twitter's DNA that, you know, and so anyway, I just think, you know, the bargain that Facebook makes with a consumer, they've kind of gone back on it.
I mean, that's why Facebook worked in the first place, right? Like MySpace and right. Friendster, these open environments. And then Facebook came in and they were like, you just connect with your friends. It's a private network. Right. And that's how they got 350 million users. Why they want to change that now is, well, I guess it's obvious because Twitter has found this great way to monetize public information. But it's not what Facebook is about. Like, Zuckerberg's got to drop this Twitter entity.
I think the one thing, my personal view on Facebook is that their core essence has been one that is not without controversy. I mean, from the initial starting of Uconnect and what might have become Facebook if there was code borrowed or not, the fact that Zuckerberg himself even states that he finds Bill Gates to be his role model, even when questioned about, you know, Bill Gates' previous unethical choices for procuring DOS and other software platforms, he just said, you know, it's just business. And so I think Facebook is now gotten to the point where it was the stealthy cat burglar that made so much money that now in the Rio de Janeiro villa that it's living in, it's gotten too fat to finally move its arm properly to pick up a diamond, and now it's tripped over itself.
Were you comparing Facebook to Cary Grant just then?
No. But I'm just saying that it was the stealthy cap that's now gotten so old and so lazy in the relative term of internet years, because we all know that's equivalent to dog years, really. that it's gotten fat and long in the tooth, and it can possibly have a coronary anytime soon if it does one more cheeseburger.
I've gotten lost in the rich colors of that metaphor.
Tapestry that was that metaphor.
That was beautiful, man.
That was me practicing my rhetoric. I will now be giving a speech sometime soon on it. But yes, I think that to just say it one more time, Facebook is precariously on a bad step, and it could fall very far soon.
Sounds like a Tiny Tim for you.
I got another Tiny Tim for that one. All right, Tim, what's your naughty for the year?
My naughty is just, you know, they have some positive qualities, but I hate them. And I'm talking about Comcast.
Oh!
So, I mean, I have a personal grudge against them for their terrible customer service and their ridiculously high prices for the quality of service you get. I mean, they continue to be a bad guy in my life personally, but I have a laundry list of stuff they did just this year that, I mean, like you talk about in January, like right in the beginning of the year, they had a run in with the FCC and they had to kill their, you know, it was like app specific throttling. You know, they were targeting whatever peer to peer and VoIP and stuff like that. So they're like, okay, we'll kill that because we're getting in trouble for it. And then they just went to, you know, consumption-based capping. And after that, I don't know if you remember this, but during the Super Bowl, they accidentally switched over to porn in a couple of markets.
Oh, yeah.
So you're watching, it was only like 10 seconds, but you totally saw a dong.
It was in Arizona, too, during the Cardinals Super Bowl. I mean, everybody was watching there.
It was the market where the Super Bowl was being watched, and they're like, oops, here you go, 10 seconds of porn. Like, what's going on?
Wow.
And after that, we've just watched them just meteorically rise in their size. They were the number three home provider of home phone services, like digital voice. And then they saw a 50% rise in profits in the second quarter, and then the third quarter it rose another 20%. And then now they're like right after that, the NBC Universal deal came on. Like Comcast is a giant, and they just keep getting bigger. Like they have, like I said, they do have their positive qualities. They were like, people said that, I don't remember what it was in, but Boston ranked it as like the number one place to work and stuff like that. And I'm sure, like, you know, when you're working for a company that just keeps growing like that, of course you're happy, you know, you've got job security there. But they're like my number one naughty by a mile.
All right, Mark, what's your view on that?
Thankfully I don't have Comcast anymore, but I can sympathize. I mean, their customer service is horrendous. And the LA Times was at the forefront of this NBC Universal deal and putting it under a fine tooth comb. And, just the comments from readers, there was a lot of just concern that like, this is the first ever, a cable company that is now owns a content company, and that, I mean, could potentially pose problems.
Gus, what's your view?
As soon as you said Comcast, Tim, I immediately thought of another company that I thought would make a nice for the nice category, and that was Roku. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, and I'm not a Comcast subscriber, but I do have a Roku player, and you know, it's not cable by any stretch, but it's free for the most part. You just got to pay for the box, and the customer service is something that I've, the poor customer service of Comcast has, is something that I've tracked. And I remember, maybe about a year ago or so, when Comcast really hit Twitter hard. You know, they're really active on Twitter nowadays. But I remember somebody on a subscriber here in Maryland commented to Comcast saying, hey, you guys can't just give lousy service for 10 years and then jump on Twitter and think you're hot stuff. That doesn't make amends.
Fight the power moment there.
Yeah.
Like, my personal grudge against them is because we pay so much for HD, and we only get, I mean, it's only a handful of channels and most of them are not truly HD, but plus they're my internet subscriber and they have consistently overcharged. I don't know how they keep adding it on, but they say that I have two modems, I have two sockets, I have two everything, and we keep having to call and sit on customer service on hold, and it keeps getting either pushed back, delegated, or resolved temporarily, but then it comes up again. So I'm just constantly battling them.
Have you called the executive support line for that one, Tim?
I'm sure they gave it to me, and it was a deadline. No, I never actually did.
All right, I'll have to put in the show notes for everyone who has issues with Comcast, because it actually is quite helpful when you're going to the executive office's call center for help.
Do I have to assume like a different role? Like, I have to speak like a highfalutin gentleman? And
nope,
have to-
nope. It's the training center / call center that's connected right to their main corporate headquarters, and so it's the place that gets stuff done if you want stuff done, and you don't have to go through 12 layers of hell.
Can I call them and say, make the TV work when it's storming outside?
Yes, you could, and you could anger them and then have the TV gods fall upon you.
Good. I will do.
Yeah, I think the one thing with Comcast, I fully agree, is that they are, because we have this explicit tag on this podcast, I can say this with full loving gratitude in my language. They are a fucking asshole. I know my language is very colorful nowhere, colorful there, but Comcast buying out NBC Universal is the first steps to the new oil barons of the 21st century. I expect them to be on Congress going, wah, 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 wah. We believe media should be protected, wah, 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 wah. And like smoking a cigar and looking like a Coswell copper pot, you know, from the Penguin, you know?
Yeah.
The idea that you're having these media companies take over content, and you know because of their service, they're going to try to kill Hulu. That's just a given. Everyone knows that's going to happen now.
Absolutely.
I mean, you compare them to another cable provider that's in the New York area, who's actually considered one of the more user-friendly ones with Cablevision. I'm sorry for anyone who can't get them in the New York area because of Time Warner's despot-like grip on the rest of Manhattan. But Cablevision provides DOCSIS 3 internet. That's multi-channel casted cable internet. At 101 megabits per second for $100 a month. The DOCSIS 3 that's coming out from Comcast for 25 megabits per second is going to be $69 a month. And then if you want 99, I think, megabits per second, it's going to be $170 a month.
It makes Long Island a good place to live.
Yeah, well, not just Long Island. They cover Pennsylvania, New York, the lower parts of New York. So if you live in Brooklyn, you'll be fine too. As well as parts of Virginia too, and Delaware.
Wait, so how is Comcast going to kill Hulu with NBC? NBC has one good show.
I gotta say, Community is a good show. You ever watch that show?
That's all right.
But the thing is, NBC was the one who got Hulu off the ground. Their majority person, even though it's shared now between Fox and Viacom.
The only thing that. The
majority of the people who started Hulu, though, like the majority of the CEOs, the CTO, are people who came out of NBC. So Papa's going to spank, and they're going to spank hard on that one, I think.
Well, what's going to happen is that Fancast Xfinity, which is only available fully to Comcast subscribers, they're going to say, oh, look, you know, they're making a ton of money off this. You know, it only requires this much, these many resources, and you get this much, you know, money. And Hulu makes only a fraction of that because it's ad-based. So, I mean, obviously, the companies are going to go where the money is, regardless of how much it screws people over. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah. Gus, what's your view on that? Did my language scare you away?
It did, actually. Sorry about that, guys. I was just juggling some other things here and got distracted.
What are you, IMing while this show is going on?
Hey, man, some of us have...
Facebook, change your privacy settings.
Yeah, I was tweeting, actually. No, I'm kidding.
Yes, about your chair-holding parking spots, correct?
Yeah. Some of us are doing low-tech stories these days, too.
Wait, you wrote about that? Not to change the subject, but you were writing about the people in Baltimore who use cones and chairs?
Yeah, it's not just a Baltimore thing. I've been trying to figure out a tech angle to it, too, you know? And but it's apparently all over the East Coast, you know, in Boston especially. You know, and, you know, these smaller cities where parking's really tight. So, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm sure we could somehow roll in, like, geocaching type parking spaces. Like, it's at this coordinate and whatever.
You could do parking location systems like they do in the airports where it's like, this parking spot's free. Just realize that there's this much crime around you. all right, so... Gus, in response to the Comcast stuff, what was your view on that?
Well, basically, I mean, I'd like to see just more competition. I mean, there's no reason why, you know, maybe I'm just behind the times here, but why does, you know, somebody like Comcast have a lock on the, you know, here in Baltimore, for instance, city residents can't get Fios. You know, and there's just this incredible, you know, I just don't see the reason for monopoly granting, at least at the municipal level here. You know, like as a Baltimore City resident, from what I've heard, the only way you can get some I think it's like a limited FiO service here in the city is if you're living in a building that's been like newly constructed. Like yeah. I've heard people living in downtown, you know, and I think it just doesn't make sense to a lot of people and like why that has to be the case these days. I don't know if you guys can explain that. Yeah.
Well, actually the one reason for the FiOS in new buildings is because the fact is they're laying whenever they're building a new building, it's for telecommunications, they require them to lay the fiber. So it's easy for them to just put the fiber in the infrastructure to every single place in the building at their POPs, or at their point of presence in the building, when it's a brand new building. To retrofit an old building, they'll have to properly and safely place fiber-connected cable that can't turn more than 90 degrees, otherwise it's dead, in old buildings. And so I can understand the fact that they have to... They're doing it only in new buildings, but at the same time, it's the way that they're doing it for where we are on the East Coast. It's almost like Comcast and Verizon are in collusion saying, okay, we won't go in your area if you don't go in our area, and we'll go in your area in some parts and vice versa, so that they can maintain this level of, you know, how much they charge the consumer.
Right. That's something I've always been suspect of, and I actually have. In November, it was only... You know, you've got your phone company ones like AT&T UVerse and Verizon Fios. Right. They only compete with Comcast in 28% of Comcast's markets. And one out of every four homes is served by Comcast. So they're just like fostering this lead. I mean...
Yeah. I would love it if my employer was able to kind of get a monopoly on news and information in Baltimore. And, you know, we kind of had that de facto monopoly years ago to a certain extent, you know, it seems grossly unfair these days.
Okay. I think for my naughty, to go away from talking about the cable industry, because that's going to cause me to have a epileptic seizure of rage.
Sorry.
That was an awesome start, sir. Who was that?
That might have been me.
Oh, Gus, that's staying in the podcast.
Yeah.
For my naughty, I have to say, this is a really tough one. Because Gus did two, I'm going to do two as well. I'm going to have to say it was Apple and Intel. The reason why is Apple... all I have to say is sometimes Apple doesn't know what's best for me. I think the first time that really pissed me off with Apple was when they released the new 15-inch MacBook Pros, and they decided to remove the Express Card slot. As a network professional, I use my Express Card slot by swapping in and out either, you know, smart like flash card readers or eSATA connectors or wireless cards or other special devices that are using the Express Card slot. And to make that the new 15-inch professional ones, the professional machine only has an SD card slot is a slap in the face because so many professionals use compact flash for DSLRs or use P2 cards for recording video from or have eSATA drives that are connected right next to their computer. And that was one of the first things that Apple did this year that really just agitated the ever-loving bejesus out of me. The second thing is, first off, denying doing an app store in the first place. You know, having all of it be web-based apps. And then when they did the app store, having this convoluted way of putting your apps into the system and then making it so that you had no clue what was inside this black box. It was like a bad hedge fund of figuring out how to get through to get, you know, your product to market. And the fact that right now they have closed the updating process. So if you had an update for an application, you can't get access to update that application and put it up because they've closed for Christmas. And then when that relates to Intel, is that Intel, I think we all know the news about how they've been very much the bad, evil empire and anti-competitive. The fact that they're, you know, when it came to large purchasers, they would say, hey, if you buy AMD, we're not going to give you a discount. Or, you know, just some of the other, you know, patent little gimmicks and things like that to make sure they could keep their thumb on any other competition. What do you guys think about that? Tim?
Well, I don't know enough about Intel's anti-competitive behavior to actually speak authoritatively on this, so I'm going to defer.
What about the Apple part of it, though?
About Apple being evil?
Slightly more evil so lately than ever.
I don't know. I've always given them a pass because it's sort of always been that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my experience, it's very closed, and it's sort of like the consumers expect that they're going to have to deal with this sort of thing. So losing the slot, yeah, I totally understand that because I use mine. I have the last MacBook that has, you know, the slot on the side, and I have not upgraded. I haven't even upgraded to Leopard or Snow Leopard, as you know. Mm-hmm. So I'm sort of holding out on the last great days of so but as far as holding them, you know, accountable or you know, for being evil, I'm not going to say they're any more evil than anyone else.
Okay, Mark?
I think you definitely have a point with Intel. I mean, the FTC is finally noticing this. They've been anti-competitive for some time, and that certainly constitutes being naughty. I'm also going to have to go against you on Apple, though, because they've always been this closed network. And the changes that you rattle off are ones that are successful. They're working. I mean, the majority of people who buy MacBook Pros are using SD cards with digital cameras, with audio recorders. You're using them a lot more often than that expansion slot, which I personally never used once. And I use my SD card slot all the time. And the App Store... Well, I was just going to say, the App Store is huge. I mean, it's hugely successful, and you've seen every other smartphone manufacturer adopt it because you use apps a lot more if it's in this like centralized place and if they're more powerful than you would mobile apps, which aren't centralized and they're hard to find.
Okay. Gus, your view.
Yeah, I think Apple kind of included an SD card slot in a way where they were kind of bowing to general consumer pressure. I mean, they were like one of the last big, you know, laptop makers to include that. I mean, I think I used to read on forums all the time of like, why doesn't Apple include an SD card slot, not only in its laptops, but in its desktops too. And so I don't know. I mean, I think the App Store, I mean, I think there's some valid criticism there and just in the inner workings for developers. But it's, you know, it's just hard to argue with its runaway success overall for the consumer, you know, like, I mean, it can be frustrating for the developer, but I tend to look at things from a consumer perspective. And right now it's just a it's really a big playground for consumers. You know, most people wish it was better organized, actually, and you could just find more relevant stuff more quickly. But from the consumer perspective, like it doesn't get much better than the Apple, than the App Store.
All right. So I do have to say, I am the last sane man of this group, then, I personally feel. Because, you know, as a consumer, yes, that's a great idea. Have in all of your MacBooks the SD card slot reader, all your iMacs the SD card slot reader. But in a professional-level notebook, as a professional that has used 15-inch laptops and now has a 17-inch but wants to go back to a 15, I no longer have that option of the expandability that an Express card could give me. I have, in my 17 right now, a Buffalo Technologies smart card reader that reads 23 different, you know, flash card reader formats, from, you know, the Sony version to all of its different sizes to SSD, the Olympus XD format, and mm-hmm. then has the ability of having an additional adapter to plug in that then reads compact flash. I mean, I'm limited now to just having this external dongle that I have to carry around with me now to do this, rather than having an internal device that can just store this into. And then also the same thing applies for eSATA. I mean, why hasn't Apple just included eSATA in all of its professional machines? I mean, you can have a USB port double sit with an eSATA port as well. And the fact is eSATA being so much faster would be a tremendous help professionally-wise, because so many drives that are for large storage now include it. Like, for example, the Drobo, or any other major, you know, NAS slash, you know, rated drive and stuff like that.
But we're just talking about the notebooks, right? I mean, this stuff is all still present in the Mac Pro setups, is it not?
They do not have eSATA in any of the Macintosh desktop machines. They just have internal SATA drive ports.
Huh, okay.
But again, like, it's a portable machine. But they take away the ability of, I mean, it's a portable machine made for professionals. It's not like, I mean, they have the consumer line, which is supposed to be the MacBooks, but the professional series is supposed to be one that would be strictly for professionals. And to remove that slot, I think, was one of the first signs that they're kind of losing the base idea of where the idea of a pro machine goes.
Well, I think, yeah, I think that's a larger question, because they've dropped the price of the entry-level MacBook Pro to like $1,199, right?
Yeah.
You know, so it's almost like they're pushing the pro as on consumers. I mean, there are probably thousands of people buying pros who really should be kept away from them.
Yeah.
You know, and they should just have like little MacBooks, the little white plastic ones, you know, and so.
So I guess my question is there comparable functionality that can be, you know, losing the Express card slot, can the same things be done? You're saying no.
I'm saying you can do some of them. Like, the only thing you can do is I could get a USB external smart card reader and have it that way. But then I have to carry that separate dongle that's a cable that's hanging off my machine with me. But one of the things I can't do, again, is that eSATA. You can't have a direct bus-connected connection for eSATA, the speeds that you get, that the full speed of your bus for data transfer with USB or even FireWire. eSATA is always going to be faster because it is using the full SATA connection, which would be, you know, the bus speed of eSATA. And for that connector, it should be using the full speed of eSATA, so it's right on the bus and not just the USB function part of it.
I was going to say that for your first point, you now having to carry a dongle, I think I would have to carry the SD card reader dongle around with me, and I feel like more people were having sacrifice in that way than they were missing the Express card.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you can get the Express card, and I just leave it in my laptop most of the time, because if I have to read a card off, I just pull it out of my camera and throw it in, but I can then switch between the other cards I carry, which are far easier to pack up than, you know, a flimsy cabled USB that's attached to this little box. I mean, that sucker, you know, a card I throw into one of my pockets and it's safe. But the cable gets tangled, twisted, turned. And I've had two of them rip on me when I've had them before, you know, when I was using that before I got the little Express card. And that was a really pain in the butt.
I totally feel you there, because I use the Express card mobile broadband modem, and I've used the USB one, and USB is hazardous. Those things are still really big. Okay. So when you have this USB modem plugged in and you're mobile and you're like, you know, for example, at CES, and you know, you're sitting on a couch or you're like planted against the wall, you really risk losing your connection at any point. Like, someone could elbow it, it could knock out, it could fall out. Hell, it's huge. So, and the Express Card one sits flush inside, and there's just an antenna sticking out. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as far as convenience goes, that's, like, you know, that's number one.
So, Gus, what's your view about dongles and things that you have to connect to your laptop directly instead of having them internally connected?
I have to say that.
What is your view on dongles?
I have to say that talking about dongles makes me very uncomfortable. It reminds me of that instance where Comcast cut into the Super Bowl and showed a picture of some guy's dongle.
So you're having a Tyler Durden influence flashback right now, eh?
Yeah, it just makes my palms sweat, and yeah, so...
Okay, so now we're going to go away from the naughty. We're going to go to the Tiny Tims, the companies who might not last much longer. I'll start with Gus. Which one's going to end up in a slab in the next couple of years?
I would have to say Palm.
I know.
It's painful.
Well, the thing is, you stole my Tiny Tim.
Oh, did I?
Yes. Yeah. All right, so explain your source of that Tiny Tim.
Well, I think it's been – I think the Pre, which, you know, has been just underwhelming in the marketplace. Like their recent – I think it was like their second quarter financial results showed that Palm sold fewer handsets in – I guess in the last quarter. And they actually lost money. I'm actually like – I pulled up a story here. But they lost money for the 10th straight quarter. You know, they're losing tens of millions of dollars every quarter. You know, and the Pre, and I guess now, like, they put out the Pixie just recently. It hasn't really moved the needle for them in the marketplace. There's no buzz. There's no hype. There's no widespread adoption. They're on Sprint, which is like the third, you know, biggest network in the country. I mean, they're going up against RIM, you know, BlackBerry and Apple and the Google Android Armada. Which actually sounds like a cool term now that I think of it. The Google Android Armada. I should trademark that. Anyway, so I don't know. I would just be surprised if they make it through 2010 without being bought by someone else, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mark, what's your view?
I'm just looking at their year-to-date stock graph right now. It's not looking too good. But hey, they're doing better than they were in 2008. I mean, they're spending so much money on advertisements, and the ads are just so stupid and bad. And I mean, they're pushing the Pixie really hard now, but I'm just not sure what's going to save them.
Mm-hmm. Tim?
I have to say, they've been performing so poorly, but I give it to them for never creating a product that is subpar. Like, every Palm thing that I've handled for the, you know, since they were whatever, US Robotics, I mean, they weren't, but, you know, or Handspring or, you know, all the way back, I've always loved their products and I've always thought it was great. And it's unfortunate that they are either managed so poorly or they just haven't gained enough market traction. I don't know exactly what it is. I know that, you know, before their margins were so low and that was what killed them. But, you know, as far as right now, their catalog is incomplete. They have one legacy item there. And I think that if they unveil the Palm Pre Plus on Verizon, that's going to be a good place for them. It's going to be good, you know, to get in with Verizon. But, you know, their new high-end product has to be something awesome.
They blew too much time on Sprint, though. I mean, they could have beaten Android to the Verizon carrier, but they wasted time with a carrier that nobody's going to use.
I absolutely agree.
I don't think they necessarily even waste their time, though. It's the fact is they had no one else. It's like that was the only person they could turn to. You know, like they were down on their luck. They knew they couldn't, like, do much. And the fact is they need to have someone buy as many phones as possible, and then they were stuck with them for a year. You know, they were indentured into their servitude to Sprint because of the agreement they had. And I think the one funny thing is I was having a discussion with a couple of friends about this, that if they do release a new phone for CES this year, we were all joking about the name, and we're thinking, what's the best name for Palm to name their new phone? And we're thinking the Palm Post, because it's pretty much the post-game wrap-up for everything that was the pre-game that they had. How'd you like that? Was that a good joke? Nice cheese ball right there?
That was good. Thank you, that was a slam dunk.
Thank you. But I have to fully agree with Tim that they are pretty much dying, and I really think that it's going to be I think that, though, they've gone out fighting the good fight, and they do have their place in Valhalla as one of the chosen warrior few. Gus, any other comments based on your Tiny Tim pick?
Well, yeah, I think Tim made a good point. I mean, they do put out really good products. They're really solid. They're nothing to be embarrassed about. So it kind of sucks to – it would suck to see them just sort of fade away, you know? But then you gotta figure, like, with BlackBerry, with the iPhone, with Google, you know, it's how many dominant players can there really be in the market, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a bummer.
Uh-huh. Mark, what's your Tiny Tim?
I may have jumped the gun a little bit with this one. Palm will probably be dead in like April, but I might be like many months out, or maybe even beyond 2010. But I picked non-3D movies in theaters. You know, James Cameron said it's going to happen, so his biographer says he can tell the future. I believe him. So I saw Avatar twice, actually, already. And I had never seen a 3D movie before that beyond, like, Honey, I Shrunk the Audience at Disneyland. But this, I mean, Avatar is freaking amazing. I mean, I can see every movie being in 3D and wanting to keep those glasses on despite how uncomfortable they are. I mean, it really adds to the experience, and they get to charge more, and I can't really see anyone wanting to do non 3D because people just want to see these movies in 3D.
This podcast brought to you by James Cameron and 20th Century Fox. So you've seen the movie twice already, and the movie that you're going to see again today, what is that again?
I believe it's called Avatar.
So
I'm not like a huge Avatar fan. I wouldn't have seen it twice like 2 days afterwards. But I'm writing a story about different types of 3D technologies that are being used and the differences between them.
I see. So you're
but still, about- I mean it's. It's freaking awesome.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think...
I haven't seen it yet, so please don't spoil it.
I think the one thing with 3D that's funny is the fact is there's a large population of people who can't see it. And, I mean, for example, I mean, recently on the most recent episode of This Week in Tech, Leo Laporte was talking about how he was born without the ability of seeing in stereoscopic vision. I can't
remember. What?
Yeah, he
was... That's a problem?
Yeah. He when he sees, it's like a chameleon where each eye sees independently.
Whoa.
That's yeah. So he's not able to – his brain can't take the two images and overlay them. So supposedly, I guess he doesn't have depth perception then either.
Wow.
But there are people who are missing an eye, or, for example, some people with glass issues, like, you know, you and me, Gus, we got to put these huge glasses on top of our already existing glasses, and that's a pain in my ass.
Yeah, I was wondering about
I tried that when I first saw it. It works. No, I mean, I saw it in IMAX, and I put the glasses on top of my glasses. I don't normally wear glasses, but I tried it, and it worked. I watched the entire movie that way. Well, it wasn't bad.
The IMAX glasses are different. They're much larger. The ones that are for, like, the real 3D that are in a lot more digital cinema screens do not fit well over your eyes. Like, I watched Up in 3D, and it was – I had to angle my glasses down, then angle the glasses over them, and then arc my neck back to get the 3D image. It was not fun.
But you enjoyed the movie, right?
Yeah. Gus, what were you saying?
I remember I saw this. I don't know if you guys remember this, but there was this concert documentary about U2 that came out. It was in 3D. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember that? It actually played in Baltimore, and it was shot with this technology that was developed by, I think, a Maryland company, a 3D technology. And Mark, you might know about this, but I thought it was an amazing just experience watching 3D in this watching U2 in this 3D format. It was like I felt like I was like 15 feet away from Bono, and I felt like I was at a concert. You know, it was really chilling to a certain extent, and just cool. So I think it has like even broader applications beyond even like cinema, beyond even movies, to like concerts, to live events, even, you know, so that can go pretty far actually if you put your imagination to it.
I saw an interview with Cameron recently where he was saying that he wants to see 3D in laptops. Like, he wants an operating system that's in 3D where you can see your iTunes window peeking out behind your browser. And for those, you wouldn't need to wear glasses because as long as you're able to orient yourself to a device, like you have your laptop stationary and you're stationary, then you can see it in 3D without wearing glasses.
Yeah, I have actually seen some of the displays that are 3D without the glasses, and I would be happy if those started becoming more predominant, but a lot of the technology that's going to be coming out for the new Blu-ray 3D standard that's coming out are requiring shuttered glasses, the ones that if you wear them, if you're under, you know, a certain age, you could have a seizure because of it.
Yeah, I mean, my prediction was just for theaters. I don't see this breaking into the home market in the next 5 years, because especially with TV adoption time, like most people I know don't even have high def TVs. Mm-hmm. Like it's not going to happen that soon.
I have a little bit of a pondering that's going to entirely replace just 2D movies, because there is still going to be a large group of people who are going to say, hey, we can't watch this movie. We need to see it in 2D.
Yeah. But how many people are born without the ability to see in stereoscopic vision? I think it's a pretty small minority.
Some people who are in war don't have an eye anymore, or someone who played with sticks. I'm saying, you know, if you play with sticks, someone's going to lose an eye.
Do not play with sticks.
Tim, we didn't hear about from you earlier on this. What do you think?
Well, the only 3D movie I've ever seen in my life was at in Baltimore. You're familiar with the power plant?
Yes, I am.
That used to be a Six Flags-owned amusement attraction in the 80s.
That is dating yourself, sir.
Very much so. And they had it was actually not just 3D. It was also a Smell-O-Vision movie, and it was called Sensorium. And you go in there, and they have these little vents in the back of the seats in front of you, and you put on the 3D glasses, and then you got these two. It was basically like a vaudeville kind of thing. They were doing this like two guys in straw hats and canes like singing and riding big wheel bicycles, and then you'd get the smells of it, and it was in 3D, and I think that probably spoiled me on 3D for the rest of my life because I have never had any desire to really, you know, I think like when you're talking about a 3D operating system, you also have people developing touch-based operating systems, and then I think about, well, how would touch and 3D work together? And then, you know, I sort of think about how do you interact with a 3D image? And it's mostly like a passive thing for the consumer. You just sort of sit there and let it be 3D, and you look at it. And I mean, I don't know. I'm not super amped on it yet, but that might just be because I have not seen Avatar yet.
You gotta see Avatar.
Yeah. That will change my glasses to rose-colored, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think the one thing with Avatar that made it different than other 3D movies when I saw it is the fact that it really – James Cameron did for 3D what photographers have done for depth of field. He literally made it a visual vocabulary that students are going to learn from now on, because he literally just – he got it on that level where literally your main focus is in front, your non-3D image is in back. And it just, you know, comes out this way. And then there are also ducks who are ringing, so.
What the hell is that?
Whose phone? Whose phone?
Sorry about that. That was mine. It's Gus.
What?
Duck Do you live in the house that on silver spoons?
The duck phone? I'm the sound effects guy today, I think.
Okay, so Tim, who is your So wait. Who's your Tiny Tim then?
Oh, my Tim? Tiny Tim is Blockbuster Video.
Ooh,
nice.
They just barely limped through the end of this decade, and they you know, I've been following them pretty closely this year, and they had that close, almost got bought by Circuit City, which would have, you know, or vice versa.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been hilarious. But they're competing against Netflix and Redbox, who are just mauling in their respective markets. Like, I mean, and here we have Blockbuster, who, you know, their importance is waning because physical video stores are, you know, people are going less, they're going to red boxes or they're streaming or getting in the mail. And so you've got this onus of real estate in one hand. And then on the other hand is they have to get into those markets to compete. So the Blockbuster's streaming, you know, their streaming offering is pathetic. Like, I don't know if you guys have even looked at it, but it's just garbage. And then they also have worked with NCR and are getting into rental kiosks, which, I mean, they're spreading themselves kind of thin, but, you know, at the same time, they're also not handling those two divisions. They're not doing it like 100%. They've also, NCR is sort of handling the kiosks, and I can't remember the company who did their streaming, but they're also handling a lot of the streaming. So they're really like, they're in a bad position, and I actually would like to see them survive, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think one thing with when you mentioned the Blockbusters, they are pretty like, I remember when I was a kid waking up at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning to get to a Blockbusters just as they opened so I could rent a video game and have it for the full 3 days. And when they went to 5 days, my mind was blown. And I think the one thing that will stand for Blockbusters or Hollywood Video, who's another video rental provider, who I don't know if they're just East Coast based, but they're
I haven't seen them here. I think it's kind of ironic that Hollywood Video is not on the West Coast.
It's like Hollywood Pizza in the Midwest. It's because they want to be like celebrities. But it's I think the one thing with Blockbuster is that they, when it came to when Blu-rays came out, I would rather rent a Blu-ray from them than rent it from Netflix any day. Because the fact is, I knew my disc wasn't going to be broken when I got
it. Oh, yeah.
And the fact that they have that, you know, monthly service. I mean, Netflix is lovely for its, you know, discs and stuff like that. But that mail-in time and getting that disc right then and right there, that with video games, too, there is no service that provides renting equivalent to renting video games that Blockbusters or, you know, Hollywood Video in our area does. I mean, you could use, you know, was it Gamefly?
Yeah, the rental one. I mean, the mail.
But it's $26 to $30 a month. And I'm like, that's the price of a new game. Why not just buy the new game instead?
Yeah, that's crazy.
And so I think, like, it was really funny is that Blockbusters was mentioned in the Josh Whedon TV show Dollhouse. A character realized that he was obsolete. So he says, wow, I've just become obsolete. Now I know what old people feel like. Or Blockbuster. And, like, as soon as he said, like, Blockbuster, I just, like, mouth went to face, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, it's the fact that it's become that, you know, predominant in culture that even TV shows are saying that is, I think, a telling sign. And I fully agree with you on the Blockbuster thing.
Yeah, once TV gets to the Blockbuster, I mean, once TV gets to a joke, you know it's already been.
Yeah. One of the things that that typified my Blockbuster experience. I haven't stepped foot inside a Blockbuster in about 5 years, but I just remember when I was younger going to it and like wanting to see some movie that had just come out on video. And, you know, you'd go to and there'd be like this wall of like 30 or 40, you know, packages of the video, and there wouldn't be one available. And I would always end up settling for some other stupid video to watch instead. And I just got tired of that as a consumer. And that's why I think like the streaming thing is, you know, I mean, it's just taken the place of, of is just eating, you know, Blockbuster's lunch, and the immediacy of that, and also like Redbox. I mean, they're pretty current with they get a lot of up to date titles, and it just feels like they're better stocked a lot of times. So
I don't know. The studios are talking about kind of changing that, putting like a 10-day wait time on new releases to not cannibalize sales.
Mm-hmm. Which could actually help Blockbuster, because the studios want Blockbuster to stick around because they're such a prolific buyer of DVDs. And, like, you know, Redbox is not going to buy as many of them.
Right.
And so, yeah, they want Blockbuster to have it, and they want people to buy it. So I'm not too thrilled about the studios, you know, cracking down on that. I thought it was like 30 days or something like that after date of release, then it's available for rental or something and streaming.
Right.
Like you were talking about Up, and I wanted to see it, but I couldn't rent it. I couldn't stream it like on PlayStation Network. Mm-hmm. They had it available, but you can only buy it. I'm like, I don't want to spend $32 on a stream. Like, I haven't gotten to that point yet.
Yeah, I think that it's that whole idea that our society is still so focused on, if I buy something, I want that physical package. I want to say, hey, that is the representation of the physical object that I own.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that I personally have moved beyond that, but I can't. Like, it just, you look at it and you look at the value of what, you know, I just want to watch this movie once. I just want to see it. I don't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think to go to the last Tiny Tim, mine, I think mine has to be consumer GPS units.
Mm-hmm. Good call.
I was talking actually to Mark about this the other night, and I think that's and he was like, that's a really nice one. And it was, I mean, you look at what Google did with their Google Maps navigation application. As soon as it was released, TomTom, Garmin, stock prices in a half. I mean, they went from being $70 a share to $35 and, you know, $40 a share. And that, I think, is a telling sign that, you know, Google, they're just going to keep giving away, because their money is not from their applications. It's from the advertising that ties into it. So they could just start giving away everything as long as they keep getting those ad space for it.
Yeah, I mean, those stocks just totally tanked. I think there's probably still going to be a place for the standalone GPS, especially things like, have you guys seen Ford Sync?
Mm-hmm.
I think just these types of like large technologies that are built into the car still have a good use. I mean, there's limitations to your phone being a GPS, mainly that you sometimes have to make phone calls when you're driving, and that hinders your ability to get navigation. So, I mean, there's probably still going to be a market for this, but it's as their stock shows, it's probably cut in half.
Gus, what's your view?
Yeah, I think that's a good call. I mean, Google is just going to drive a lot of I think already, like, they've had to slash prices on a lot of their products, and at least their iPhone, some of the iPhone apps that are out there, you've seen them drop in price. You know, like, you just, when you have a viable, usable product, it's hard to compete against it when you're not free, you know? So I think, we were talking a little bit about this earlier, but I think it's incumbent on these GPS makers they got to figure out another way to make money. It's the same way that newspapers are having to figure out another way to make money, you know, because the advertising market's been taken away from them, you know, by so many other online publishers.
And advertising is a way that they can make money. I mean, you look at Google Maps, they have the coffee shop ads built right into the map, so you see it as you drive by.
Yeah, I mean, the question is like, well, you know, can TomTom, as a company, can they pivot? Can they really adopt a new business model? I mean, that's a management problem for them.
Well, that's a good point, because Google has been working with these small companies and these down-home local cafes for years and years building up to this.
Right, yeah. you just see like this grand plan evolving that's just starting to play out with Google, and it's both fascinating and a little scary to watch.
So the Google has a plan, and this is how they're going to do it? Because, you know, I was totally making a Battlestar Galactica reference there.
Oh.
Missed.
Whoosh.
Swing and a miss. At least I'm not Tiger Woods. So, Tim, what's your view on this? You're the guy who's all things Android, so Google would be right up your alley on this one, I think.
Well, personal navigation devices were sort of a fad of like 2 years ago. Or 2008, I guess, or 2007, the holiday season, all of these companies who made the hardware were just like rolling in. Uh-huh. And then suddenly it hit the wall. They hit a saturation point. And that was when you started to hear about theft of GPS units from cars. And then, you know, it sort of became like a – I looked at it as sort of like a pet rock kind of thing. Like people had it and they were like, yeah, it's cool. It works. It's okay. And – so, and then there was this lull, and that's when Google stepped in. And so there was a lull in the navigation device market. Meanwhile, companies like Telenav, which did the software, they made like the white label navigation for like AT&T, Verizon, Sprint. And they did really well. They had no hardware until this year, actually. They released their own. And I was talking to them earlier this year, and they were saying that the real crucial aspect that makes cell phone navigation so much better is the fact that it is not just the satellite communication, that it has that data to fall back on. So like TomTom and Garmin and what are the other ones? Magellan, I think. And the majority of their products are just GPS only. So, you know, you need that data line to back up so you get fresh information so you can serve ads, like you were saying, if you know, you get to the point where you can do that.
And for some of them, they charge like a monthly fee for things like traffic and, local up-to-date locations. I mean, get out of here. Nobody's going to...
Right.
Speaking of holiday fads, can I throw one more Tiny Tim out there?
Go right ahead. We have another 10 minutes left in the podcast, sir.
All right. E-readers. It's this year's holiday fad. They're not going to be around next year. Not that many people read books.
Get out.
It's going to be all in-one devices. Tablets are going to take over next year. I'm getting the embargoed press releases. Tablets are coming, and e-readers are not going to make it.
Well, aren't e-readers just basically the first line of tablets? I mean, anyone else remember the first laptops when they came out? They were monochromatic, too.
Yeah, I mean, but something like Barnes & Noble's Nook, I mean, that's not even going to last a year.
They could easily update that to being a PQ-colored screen or some other low-powered, non-light-emitting, you know, colored format. I think the fact is that technology that they have there, they have a baseline that they can just evolve easily.
When you say e-readers are going to die, are you talking about e-readers as like a device class, or are you talking about electrophoretic displays? Like, are you talking about e-paper?
No, I'm talking about the device class that can specifically only do e-paper. Okay. I'm thinking there's going to be like tablets that have a switch. You turn it between e-paper and an LCD, and it's your computer. You can access the internet, and you can also do books.
That'll be cool. I like electrophoretic. I think the e-paper thing is awesome as far as low power consumption mm-hmm. and resolution. Unfortunately, the fact that it doesn't blink really screws with people, and you don't see animations taking place on those screens. So, like, right now, it's almost e-books or nothing on those things.
Well, the one thing that's funny is Fujitsu, in a demo in a Taiwan trade show, showed off a 30 frame per second color moving image e-paper technology, and you can find it. There was links to it on Engadget as well as Gizmodo, and you can find it on YouTube as well. It is actually really nice looking image. I mean, it's pretty good. It's like it's the quality of any printed magazine in quality image. It looked like to me a little bit weird, you know, when they had the light directly shining on it because of the way the color spectrum was.
Yeah,
but it still was providing the color image and motion video. Now, I do agree that having something like an organic LED with that combined where it's that translucent layers would be something I would really love to see, because then you could have, like, one of those panels between them that, you know, like, when you put electricity through it, it causes it to become a white frosted window. Have, like, one of those between it, so that way none of the light or, you know, background image that's on the LCD can travel through, but still have it be that transparent e-paper at the same time.
That would be cool.
Gus, what's your view?
I agree with Mark. I don't think the e-reader, like, is going to be that long around. I think it's telling that Amazon, I don't think they release unit sales, right, of the Kindle. Right. I think the only estimates that are out on the market is, like, one analyst, I think he, like, triangulated in on a number because he figured out how many subscriptions or how many, like, activation accounts Sprint's WhisperSync had activated.
Nice.
You know, it was really curious. You know, so, I mean, when a company doesn't, you know, when a company that's leading in the space is not willing to trumpet its own, you know, successes or, you know, or not, you know, I think that's kind of telling overall. I think, you know, it kind of makes me wonder, like, you know, we focus on devices specifically, and, like, maybe, like, people are really just geared towards, they want the same kind of product, but, like, in different sizes. You know what I mean? Like, they want, like, an iPhone that they can fit in their pocket, but then they want something a little bit bigger that they can watch video on and read a book on comfortably. But, you know, they want it, you know, sort of with that same simplicity and form and function as an iPhone. You know, a little bit bigger, the size of an e-reader, and then they want a laptop. You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's just all about finding the right form. You know, and for that all-in-one type of device.
Which bed is just right for you kind of thing.
Yeah, Goldilocks. Yeah.
I think we're going to have to end up the podcast now. It's an hour and 28 minutes into recording right now. So, everyone, thanks for being on the show. Tim Keneally, where we can find more of your work?
You can find me at Tim Keneally on Twitter. My writings are also on betanews.com and androidbakery.com. Okay.
Mark Millen, where can we find more of your work?
LATimes.com/tech, or my link to Twitter is on my personal blog at heyniceblog.com.
And Gus, where can we find more of your work?
I'm at twitter.com/GusSent, or baltimoresun.com/BaltTech.
Okay. This has been Patrick Ronenhaus from the Planet Podcast for our holiday episode of the Nice, the Naughty, and the Tiny Tim. Have a great holiday. Goodbye. Thank you.